Herzlich willkommen auf den Spuren alter Kulturen, einem Podcast des Marburger Zentrums Antike Welt. Heute im Studio sind mein Co-Moderator Rico.
Hallo.
Sowie unser wundervoller Gast Anna Martins, die den weiten Weg aus Portugal bis zu uns auf sich genommen hat. Mein Name ist Florian. Bevor wir ins Thema einsteigen, hier der Hinweis, dass das folgende Gespräch in englischer Sprache geführt wird. Wie in vielen wissenschaftlichen Bereichen ist es auch in den Altertumswissenschaften so, dass Vernetzung, insbesondere auch internationale Vernetzung und Tätigkeitsfelder, unabdingbar sind. Gute Kontakte zu internationalen Kolleginnen und Kollegen, wie im Beispiel hier, gehören also zu unserem wissenschaftlichen Alltag. First of all, I would like to extend a warm welcome to today's guest. Welcome, Anna. Nice to have you here.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for your invitation.
In this episode, we are joined by archaeologist Anna Martins, whose work focuses on Roman ceramics, with a special interest in Terra Sigillata, a fine, glossy tableware that traveled all across the Roman world. She is currently pursuing her PhD on this topic, based between Évora and Granada, and funded by the Portuguese Foundation for Science and Technology. Together, we'll talk about why pottery matters in archaeology, what makes Terra Sigillata fascinating or special, and how researchers approach this material to uncover patterns of production, trade, and maybe the ancient daily life. Anna, you have devoted much of your research and time to Terra Sigillata, and don't seem bored by the subject yet. Where does your long-term fascination for this type of source come from?
Well, first, I made all of my studies, bachelor and master's, in Évora, which didn't used to have a big tradition of studying ceramics, at least in the Roman part, when I was studying there. I always liked them, and I always had this big interest about the ceramics. And when I started my master, I thought that maybe the master thesis was a good idea to start learning more about it. And then I continued it in my PhD. I didn't get bored of it. Sometimes I'm a bit more annoyed than bored about them, but until now, not totally bored. I still have some fascination about this.
All right. Maybe later we can dive a little bit into this annoyances you mentioned. So could you maybe, as an introduction, give us and our listeners an idea of the historical development and spread of these ceramics you are studying?
Well, the ceramics I'm studying, it's Terra Sigillata. It's a Roman ceramic, probably the most well-known Roman ceramic or type of ceramic. They were made since the 1st century BC until more or less 1st century, maybe a bit earlier, until the 6th AD. The first ones to be produced were in the eastern part of the empire, like we have these Eastern Sigillata. And then the Italian ones, they spread along all the empire, the first productions. They start to make it also in the Gaulish region and some other regions too. First imitating the Italian shapes and then creating their own shapes and their own decorations. The same has happened in our case with the Hispanic Sigillata, which are the ones that are produced in Hispania, in the Iberian Peninsula. Then there are also other productions like the African ones or the late productions also from the eastern part of the empire. These type of productions are very good for us archaeologists. Their state of art is already very well developed. We are now able to give better chronologies to the sites we are studying because they are very, like I said, very well dated, and it also helps us to study the economic connections inside the Roman Empire, because each production was made in one site and they were sold all along the empire, and for us this is an important thing.
Just from my point of view, I study a different field in ceramics, but also ceramics of the Bronze Age. Always I'm hoping I would need something like Terra Sigillata, because for me it looks very good, distinguishable, like, okay, you can see one form and you know where it has been produced and at what time, and also the material is really nice in the hand. So a little bit I envy you, but I think it's not easy to work on this topic too. I mean, you have so many different shapes to know, right? I mean, how can you learn all the shapes?
I At first, I agree with you with the shiny and beautiful parts. For me, it was also one point to choose this type of ceramics to study. Then sometimes it's difficult. Well, first, some productions are really, really similar. For example, I have a huge problem distinguishing between a very, I don't want to call it bad, but a more rough South Gaulish production from a good Hispanic one. Sometimes it's very, very difficult for me to distinguish them. Also because they are imitations, and sometimes, for example, the Hispanic ones are imitating the South Gaulish. And sometimes they are very, very, very similar and very well done. And even the clay is very similar sometimes, the color, and just looking at it without any laboratory analysis is difficult.
Yeah, but this is also really interesting. I mean, you have the South Gaulish ceramics, like Sigillata, it's south of France, I think, and the Spanish ones, and the Spanish workshops try to imitate the South Gaulian ones. I mean, why?
Yes, at some point, I think the Gaulish workers, they moved to Spain to install the first workshops and to start producing from there at the beginning of the production of Sigillata. Some of the stamps, I think they're quite similar, and the idea is that they moved there to start producing it in Hispania too.
I think at this point, I would like to take one or two steps back to a more general view, because now we're already in some very specific topics, which are very interesting. But maybe first have a general view. Could you just give us like a short explanation of why the studies of ceramics is important in archaeology? You already mentioned in your introduction some of those topics, but maybe you can dive into this a little bit more. And then we might find the connection to what you just said of people moving, for example, and also the stamps where we have individuals actually acting.
Yes. So to make it more complete, well, at first you had, like I told you before, the Italian workshops. And also there is the idea that some of the Italian producers moved to the Gaulish region to start producing there. And then the same happened with the Gaulish going to the Iberian Peninsula. Well, yes, for us archaeologists, it gives us this type of information. The trade between the inside of the empire or even the outside, like you have here in Germany, where you see that the Romans had contact with the people living outside of the Limes. I mean, for us, it's a very good way to see how they used to live and the things they used to trade. Also, it's the same with the ceramics. And I think in the Sigillata case, for having so much demand, people were buying it a lot, that they needed more production centers. Also, at some point, for example, I know in Mérida, they haven't found yet a production center, but there are lots of imitations of Terra Sigillata, another type of ceramics imitating the shapes of the Sigillata. Mm-hmm. It gives us a good information. We can see that the Roman world was so globalized that everyone was using more or less the same things. Like us, for example, today with the IKEA stuff, we all have the same things all along the world or the Occidental part. And I think with the Sigillata and other stuff and amphoras and all the ceramics, they did more or less the same. The example I have is the Sigillata. You can find the same shapes all along the empire, sometimes with different productions, but the similar shapes. And you see the taste of the people, that's what they like and what they see and they want to use.
Why do you think is that it was so standardized? Was it just like a fashion to have a certain type of ceramics, and this fashion traveled then across the whole empire? Or why do you think do we have this high degree of standardization?
I think that's one reason that they wanted to keep, and if we can use the word fashion, yes, is that they wanted to keep with the same taste as in the entire empire. The reason that the shapes that are most commonly spread are the ones that were easier to not only to produce, but also to transport. They were not having the shapes that were most difficult to transport, but the easier ones, the shapes that were good to travel all around since the production centers until the rest of the consumption areas. But yes, I think they had this standardization of shapes, mostly for fashion and... Normally, when you see the courseware, you think about the best way to use it and the simplest way to use it, but in this case it was not just that. And also sometimes, or at lots of times, the sigillata was also imitating some other shapes, for example, shapes of glass or shapes of metal. It was the closest thing that was imitating those shapes. For the ones that could not afford the metal of the glass versions of the fancy thing, maybe the sigillata was the first option.
And maybe it was so liked by the people, so everybody wanted to buy the sigillata. Maybe they also thought, like us, oh, it's so shiny and looks so good. Could it be a reason that it was so widespread? Or
yes, I think it could be a possibility, yes.
And it is also nicely decorated.
Yes.
This is where the names comes from.
Sigillata comes from this expression, the word sigillata comes from the stamp, from sigillum, the stamp that the first productions used to have with the name of the potter or the workshop or the owner of the workshop. This came from the 18th century. The Romans didn't call it sigillata. We're not sure yet what they used to call it. But the expression we use, sigillata, came from the sigillum, the potter's stamp, in the different types of productions, which is also good. So you already have studies from different potters and where does their products arrive. And also some potters have some specific decoration types also. Yeah.
So far we have, I think, focused more on the why side. So why do we study this? What kind of questions can be maybe answered with this special sort of ceramics? Now, I would like to maybe change the focus a little bit more to the how. How do you actually study this kind of ceramics? So maybe just very basic, or start very basic. When you approach a new assemblage of ceramic finds or terra sigillata finds, what kind of steps do you have to go through in this study? What is usually necessary?
Well, it really depends on the state. How the things are. For example, for my master thesis, I had a collection of ceramics from an excavation. The excavation was in 2004, but the things were still like they came from the excavation. So everything was still too clean. All the ceramics and other stuff were together in the same bags. Some of them already without the indication of the layer or where did they came from. Well, in that case, I had to open all the bags, look for the sigillata fragments. I had to wash all of them to mark it, to put them together, to see if they have some part of the same.
To get the whole bowl or the whole piece of pottery, try which pieces could match together.
I had to try that part too, make the entire inventory, the photos, the drawings. That's a case where the work had to be more complete. The part of the washing and of the marking of the ceramics sometimes used to be done by someone from a conservation office. Lots of cases we don't have them with us, working with us, so we have to do it. In that case, I had to. Then I passed to the exact part of the study. Now for my PhD, for example, I've had some collections that were already prepared and washed and with their marks, and that makes it easier. When it's a case like from my master's, I really have to make everything, almost all the steps. I didn't took them from the field, but the rest I had to do it.
And from where did you took it? Is it a special place like in Portugal where you worked, or?
They were from an excavation in Faro, and the archaeologist, she was not alive anymore when I started to study it. They had it saved in Tavira, in a place of an association they used to have that didn't exist anymore. So in Tavira, they found this, they had these ceramics there, and they decided to send it to Faro, where they belong, because the excavation was in Faro. And once I was talking to them, telling them I would like to study something of ceramics for my thesis and something Roman, they just told me, oh, we just sent from here to Faro a nice collection. You should go there and take a look at it. So it just arrived to the museum. It was, I don't remember how many, but it was around 20 containers, these small containers full of stuff.
How many pieces are we talking in the end?
Well, first I had to open all of it and look for the ceramics. At the end, in pieces, it was like 1,000 something, counting the diagnostic and the non-diagnostic shards. And at the end, the number of the minimal number of individuals, I don't remember, it was something around 500. But to find those, I had to go all around those ceramics and to wash at least all of the sigillata I found.
And so you drew them all and you took photographs of them all.
Yes. After,
so it takes a long time for, especially if they have like stems or decoration. I mean, to draw this is really difficult, right?
Yes, after the washing and the marking and the inventorying, yes, I photographed at least all the diagnostic ones that are the ones that can give us a shape or any idea of the type of vessel that we have there. Then, yes, I draw all of them and I photographed all of them. In this case, with the decoration, I drew all of it, mostly with the help of the photographs. This time for my thesis, for my PhD, I'm only using, or mostly using only the photos, if they are good photos, because I have no time to draw all of it.
And for your PhD, is it the same find spot? Is it also Faro, or is it from another place?
Now it's from another region. I'm studying some sites along the Guadiana River in the south of Portugal. In some parts, it's the division of the border between Portugal and Spain. And in some areas, it was a division between Lusitania and Bética.
Which are the two Roman provinces.
Yes.
Now you study from many different places.
Yes, now I have ceramics from several places from the south of the territory and until Alentejo, which is in the center south of the country.
So now you're also working on like on a different scale.
Yes.
So for the first you were like on the city basis, more or less, and now you're taking it to the region, if I understand that correctly.
Yes.
With the study of material, you already mentioned some very important, I think, keywords, like diagnostic pieces and minimal amount of individuals. Can you maybe point out why is it important to know how many vessels are there in the end for the study or for the analysis? And what is a diagnostic shard? What makes it diagnostic?
A diagnostic shard, a shard that gives us information that can help us to find out what type of vessel it was. For example, it can be a rim, a base, a wall with a decoration, a handle, something that gives you the information for you to know which type of vessel it was. Imagine that we have these Dragendorf 27 that are the ones that make like the two parts of like a moon shape. They are very, very easy to identify. Even if you find the wall of it, you know, if you find the center, you know which type of vessel it will be. So this can count as a diagnostic shard.
All right. Could you tell our listeners, when we are archaeologists, what is this Dragendorf typology or anthropology maybe at all?
Yes. So, and like we were talking before about the typologies, we have several works from archaeology works with already the typologies for our ceramic types. So each vessel has one name, number. Like the Dragendorf, we have several of them. Like each type of vessel has one different shape and every different shape has a different name and number. And we use those works for us to standardize our works. We use the Dragendorf typologies for the South Gaulish ones. We use the Hayes for the late productions. I don't know if I answered you quite well.
Yeah, it's interesting because the typology is so linked with some of the researchers, right? I mean, Dragendorf or Dressel, or you mentioned one more.
Hayes.
These are the names of the researchers who researched.
In this case, yes, Dragendorf and Hayes, yes. In this case, it was their names. For example, in the Hispanic sigillata, well, now I use the work of my professor, Macarena Bustamante Alvarez, that she just calls it Forma 1, Forma 2, Forma 3, so not giving her name to it, but just calling shape 1, shape Hispanic shape 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, but it has a long tradition calling it after the actual researchers who established these forms of typologies, which I think is a bit different in the prehistoric part, no?
Yeah, for example, in my field of research, we don't use the name of who established the typology, but somebody is establishing a typology and after other people use the same descriptors. For example, in my field, it's like S1 is Schale type 1. Schale is the German word for bowl, or like Krug 1 is K1. But then another researcher comes and makes the same thing, but with different names. And this is really difficult. So I really like it in Terra Sigillata that you speak of Dragendorf whatever 27 and everybody knows, you mean this shape.
For example, Hayes, he doesn't give his name to it. He calls form 1, 2, 3, but the researchers started to call it Hayes 1, Hayes 2, Hayes 3. So.
Because it is so universal, so that it can be applied in very wide areas. Yes. What I was referring to in prehistory is, I think, that you always mention the site where it was found, the site the typology is basically based on, or am I taken wrongly there?
Yeah, I think in prehistory, you cannot say it's like this or like that because it's changing everywhere. So, yeah, at some places you use the name of the site or also just with shape. But I can just speak for the Anatolian prehistory, and maybe somewhere else also people use their names, or the names of the people will be used for special kind of typology.
Well, it happened, for example, with the late productions. The ones that Hayes calls Late Roman 1 or Late Roman 2. It was also used to be called Fusens 1, Fusens 2. So they used to be called like that, but now we call it Late Roman 1, Late Roman 2, and not mentioning the region anymore. But that's as with the sigillata, because, for example, if you notice in the studies of amphoras or in the studies of lamps, sometimes they have different names for it, and they have to say, for example, it's a dress or something, and then all the other names for this type of ceramic. I think in sigillata we are a bit lucky. All of us are trying to use the same terms to classify it.
But I think also the material is really helping you because it is so standardized, or relatively speaking, standardized with other shapes in time and space. But speaking of this, I'd be interested a little bit in any limitations, maybe, which you might encounter during an analysis. So either on the technical part or on the material itself or on the selection of materials, is there something?
Well, the first limitation is sometimes for us to talk with the institutions where they have the materials. Sometimes it's easy to talk to them and have an authorization to make the study. Others is more difficult, and then sometimes you need lots of papers, and this is the first difficult part.
So the accessibility of the material.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes. Others is just, okay, it really depends on the place and on the people working there. After that, the limitations, like I give you my master thesis as an example, if the materials are not already washed and marked and all of that, it also can be a limitation because sometimes you have deadlines and you're there investing lots of time in the washing of ceramics. This is another limitation. Other things, like we were talking before, also trying to distinguish some types of productions. Sometimes it's not easy either.
Well, because why is it easier in some cases than in others?
Well, in some cases when they have very specific decorations, that there are some types of decorations that you look at it and you say, well, this is an Hispanic sigillata for sure. There is one type of decoration that is these concentric circles, that you have one decoration and then two, three circles around it. This is very typical from the Hispanic sigillata, for example. But sometimes you also have Hispanic productions imitating the decoration of the Gaulish ones, and where they are very, very well done.
The clay
is very, very well worked also. This makes it more complicated. When you don't have lab analysis, it's more difficult.
So we had the accessibility, we had time constraints, we had the material issues, which make maybe the analysis more complicated. But what is about the actual selection of the material in the excavation? So, because as far as I understand it, this, especially this Terra Sigillata, is like a backbone for chronology and for huge theories which are built on this. But from experience, I would say that maybe the selection of the material changes a lot where exactly you're excavating. Can you maybe dive into this a little bit? How about the representativity of these materials which we have? And maybe also focus a little bit on the importance of comparing the own excavation with other sites.
You mean, for example, all the quantities of ceramics we bring from one site? I mean, we are archaeologists, and you know it depends. Sometimes it depends where we open the trenches. If we are not excavating the entire site, we will never know the exact quantity of ceramics that we had there. Well, we can be lucky and like we can find a tank full of ceramics, or we can find nothing.
It's a lottery. But are there any techniques with which you can maybe control this a little bit?
I don't think we can control where to. With geophysics, you can control where to open the trench and the structures you will have there. About the ceramics, I don't know if there is some new technology to find them, but I don't think.
For example, in Turkey, when we excavate, we don't need a special technology to find the ceramics because it's everywhere. If you want or not, you find a lot of it.
Yeah, but how do you make sure that the pieces which you are actually collecting are representative for what you're studying?
I mean, you can excavate a big part and you should hope that it's statistically enough amount of pottery to use and to get a result which is like comprehensive. But of course, it's difficult to define how many ceramics you need because you don't know how many ceramics you have in total because you never will excavate all the place. Yeah.
Yes, that's it. And for example, when you're working in a construction site inside of a city, it's even more difficult. For example, there was a place very close to my master thesis that had way less quantities of African sea, for example. And it was studied by Katarina Viegas, and she immediately said that it may not be an indicator because it might depend where the trenches were open. And then you saw that she was right, because in the place where I was studying, it was in the other side of the road, there was the African sea like she was expecting.
Yes, so you need the experience to not interpret your results wrongly. So you should have in mind, okay, it could be an exception here that you don't have the African sea where, but most probably it's here, but we just did not excavate it.
Yes, I think we can never say that this type of production doesn't exist in this place. It might exist and we haven't found it yet. It can happen a lot.
Yeah. So this is this typical sort of ex nihil argumentation saying it's not there, so it was never there. So this is something which you say, especially in ceramics.
Well, I have a friend of mine that says, let me see if I can translate this from Portuguese to English. She's always repeating this. She's also studying ceramics. She's a medievalist, but it's ceramics the same. Ausência de evidência não é evidência de ausência. Now, how do I translate this?
The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence.
Yes.
Yeah, perfectly put.
And,
perfectly put.
But I mean, in archaeology, we are dealing with this.
And every time I complain, I don't have here something that I really wanted. And then she started, don't forget it. It might exist. I know it might exist, but I would really like to have it.
Yeah. But yeah, this is also a very universal principle which we have in archaeology in special, because we always have just a tiny selection of what is in the ground and what was at some point being put there in the ground, and of what was at some point even used in the ancient cultures we are studying. So we're very aware of this whole selection process, which gets there in different steps. So, yeah. Okay, so we already were talking about trade and a little bit, or at least of the exchange of ideas, but also about chronology. Could you, from your point of view, also maybe dive into this a little bit more? How do you create chronologies with this Siglata? Now we are on the protation side. So how does it help with chronology of sites?
Okay, it depends on the type of excavation and in the type of site, of course. Well, you have a good example. Let me see if I can explain this. If you have good stratigraphy, you know you will be able to date it layer by layer, and you know that the Sigillata is very well already studied, and you have sometimes for some sherds you have a 15-year difference, and you can really straight your chronology. Another good thing of the Sigillata is that even if you don't have stratigraphy or a very well-preserved stratigraphy, is that you can use it to date the site without the stratigraphy. It's not the ideal, but sometimes we have very old excavations to study. We just know that the pieces came from there, but we don't know in which layer. But even only with the Sigillata, you can give it lots of information, again, about the chronology, when the site started to be occupied, when it stopped being occupied, or at least to have an idea of it. Still can learn about its connections with another site or with another part of the empire. This is one of the things that make this type of ceramic very, very important, because if you have stratigraphy, it is perfect, but if you don't have, you still can work with it.
Because in the overall picture, it is so very well studied.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you said, like, you have a range sometimes about 15 years. I mean, it's way better than, like, C14 or other methods which are applied. I mean, in C14, you have a range about 200 years or 50 years. I mean, with Terra Sigillata, it's way more precise than...
Yes, we had that in Boca, right, where we tried, I don't remember very well, the C14 measurement.
For context, Boca do Rio is a project we have been working on for a couple of years. It's a coastal site in southern Portugal, in the Algarve. There we both did huge ceramic studies, but also dating with C14 and other technologies. And there we have the special case that much of the material which we were dating with the C14 did not come like from land animals and from land plants, trees, but from the sea or the seafood. And this is a very special case already, which makes the C14 method even more coarse. So you're not only talking about 100 or 200 years, but 300, 400, 500 years, because there's several reservoir effects, which we don't have to get into detail now here, but this shows the whole discrepancy which we have sometimes between methods which in general we consider very specific and relatively precise and universally working in comparison to ceramic studies, which not in every type or everywhere we do have this good chronological frame.
Yes, in this case, they helped us a lot. And yes, even more than the C14 or that, because, again, the state of art is already so developed and the research about it is giving us new information all the time, so we really can use it to date a site, sometimes even more precisely than these techniques.
So you were talking about the new information coming from new studies. Are you talking there like lab studies, like petrography or a chemical analysis, or what are you thinking about?
Well, for new studies, I was first thinking about studies of sites being excavated now and research about the ceramics from those sites and sometimes with a very preserved stratigraphy. About the lab analysis, yes, they gave us information that we cannot take from the ceramics just by looking at them, like in a microscopic way. It gives us information about the cooking temperatures of the ceramics, the exact minerals that the clay has or the new ones that were created during the burning of the ceramic. This is the, and other information, but this is the type of information that we cannot take just by looking at it. And this is a great help to develop even more the study of this type of ceramic.
Did it also happen that the established types, which are dated very well, had to be redated because of new research? I mean, date of Dressel or Dragendorf, I don't know, whatever, change over time? Or can you say, oh, the old results of Dragendorf, they still can be used today?
No, it happens a lot. We have, for example, like in the South Gaulish productions, just an example, there is these ones that are imitating marble. We call it marmoriada. That is a specific type of South Gaulish sigillata that imitates the marble. It is yellow and reddish. And at the beginning, they thought it was just a Flavian production or just produced during the Flavian period. And then with new excavations in Lag Halfzank, they discovered that no, it was produced all along the, since the beginning until almost the end of the production of the site. Again, also, for example, with the Hispanic productions, my professor's thesis, she studied a very good context in Mérida, and it really helped the state of the investigation about these ceramics, because it is giving us new information about chronologies, about the productions, because it's state of art and the research about it is quite new comparing to other productions. All the time we are adding new information to this.
And refining the framework. Yeah, great. Thank you, Anna. Thank you for this overview. I think they are closing in. We're reaching about our time limit now. But maybe one final question, like the typical one. Where do you see yourself in 10 years? No, seriously. Looking ahead, what do you think, what areas of research in Roman ceramics hold more promise or will get more or less exciting in the future? Where do you see this field going to or developing to? Or maybe new technologies coming in?
I think it will always continue to be important because you have lots of new technologies and geophysics and everything, but what gives you always a good date, at least for a Roman site, it's the ceramics. Even like we talk even more than the other dating methods. So I think it will continue to be a very important part of archaeology. Maybe the new technologies will help us to make our work faster, probably. Now there are colleagues trying to develop some apps to help us identify the shape of the ceramics and this type of things. Yes, I think it will be a great help. And again, so we can make our job faster. The same with the drawing. I know there are already machines that can draw you the ceramics and all of this. Maybe these new technologies can help us to make the process faster. But I don't think that we can replace ceramic studies for something else. I think it will always be a very important part of archaeology.
Which I would say is not a bad thing.
No, it's not.
Because it's very important and there's many people liking this study, a type of study. So, well, thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your concluding remarks. Thank you for sharing your time with us and your research. Well, and to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this conversation, this episode, then feel free to join us again with the next one, which should be appearing in about 2 weeks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for being here.